From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast.
Welcome to the March 2023 episode of the Bletchley Park podcast, Bletchley Park Poetry. To celebrate World Poetry Day, 21st of March, we've been looking into the poets and poetry of Bletchley Park. We've chosen 9 poems to feature on this episode, and they'll be read by staff, volunteers, and Bletchley Park veterans. We've got Dr. Thomas Cheetham with us, who's been digging into the archives to give us more information as we listen. Tom.
It's about time we did poetry at Bletchley, isn't it, really?
Yes.
Anyone who knows anything about Bletchley Park knows this place had a thriving cultural scene during the war. So we know about the drama group, the music society, ballroom dancing in the mansion, and all of these things. But alongside these organised activities, there were sort of lots of low-level individual ways that people sought to understand their lives at Bletchley. And one of these was poetry. And I find it really interesting how the character of the place, this unique institution, and the wartime situation, of course, and often it's the absurdity of the contrast between the informal atmosphere here and the very formal way you fight a modern war, which seems to have been such fruitful inspiration for poetry here. And what I also find fascinating is there was definitely a shared cultural identity at Bletchley. Even though you've got this compartmentalisation, you're not allowed to know what your colleagues are doing in their own offices. But certainly among the more senior and more skillful staff, like those cryptanalysts and intelligence officers who might know a bit more about what's going on, they do have a shared identity. They understand this was a strangely diverse organisation they're part of, and they have a unique identity in the secrecy as well that exists here. And that's all well recognised. And this comes through in the poetry as well. So you have a process where poetry is written by individuals or maybe for small groups of people, but then it starts to become shared more widely and often gets incorporated into these reviews and performances, and lots of people get to see it. Mm. And of course, Bletchley Park is not unique in any of this. Back in World War II, there's lots of war poets who have nothing to do with Bletchley Park. Poetry was simply more popular back then as a way for people to muse on their experiences. So lots of poetry around being written, but Bletchley Park's particularly connected to the art form. And firstly, that's because by recruiting so many talented people, naturally a proportion of them were published poets. Mm-hmm. So you have people who are very well known as leading poets during World War II, people like Henry Reed with The Naming of Parts, and Frank Templeton Prince, who authored Soldiers Bathing, both worked at Bletchley Park. And there's other people like Vernon Watkins, F.L. Lucas and Patrick Barrington. Mm-hmm. But on the other side, you have those amateurs who were never published poets, but write poetry anyway. We've got many, many in our collections, which are written basically for fun.
The kind of on the back of a piece of scrap paper
in the office. Yeah, in a spare moment.
Yeah.
And it's not hard to see how they help people break up the drudgery. They help them connect with their colleagues and share humour. And it helped them process their experiences of working here. Mm-hmm. So it's the relationship between the two that I find really fascinating. But we're going to start with the most famous, probably the number one most famous poem of the Second World War, let alone of Bletchley Park, mm-hmm. which is The Naming of Parts by Henry Reed.
Tell us more about the poet Henry Reed.
So Henry Reed is a literary figure. Before the war, he studied poetry in a few institutions. During the war, he serves in the RAOC, the Royal Army Ordnance Corps, from 1941 to 1942. And this is the period which inspires the poem for which he's most famous. But he's invalided out of the army quite quickly. Maybe that's why he muses so much on his basic training. And he comes to Bletchley Park in about April 1942. And the poem seems to have been written just before he came to Bletchley. So it's quite interesting to think about him as this figure who's already created his greatest work when he arrives here. And he comes into the Italian naval section, works in Italian for a few years. And then when the Italian war is finished, a lot of those staff go over to Japanese. And Henry Reed clearly excels at Japanese. He is an attendee to one of the first naval section Japanese courses, which is organised here. Later on, he actually assists in running those courses. So has quite an active involvement in the Japanese work going on in naval section.
So what is it about Naming of Parts that managed to make it so famous?
You know, it does seem to be the standout poem of World War II because it encapsulates that experience. We tend to know more about war poems of the First World War. Mm. And those are all about bloodshed on the battlefield. And they are really about the horrific experiences that the soldiers are going through. Second World War poetry is a bit different. What it's really about is the experiences of millions of amateur citizen soldiers coming into contact with military culture for the first time and with state authority. And this is quite new for that generation compared to their fathers who'd served in World War One. They're notably better educated. They're sort of more culturally aware. But they have this irreverent and undeferential attitude to authority compared to their father's generation. And one of the features of how the army has to work in World War II, it has to become somewhat softer, more democratic, and it has to treat its soldiers as citizens, as well as just cannon fodder, almost. Telling soldiers not just what they must do, but why. And I think the poem taps into that clash of civilian and military cultures, and that's why it's gained such prominence.
So here's Henry Reed's Naming of Parts, read by our wonderful volunteer, Harold.
Today, we have naming of parts. Yesterday, we had daily cleaning. And tomorrow morning, we shall have what to do after firing. But today, we have naming of parts. Japonica glistens like coral in all of the neighbouring gardens. And today we have naming of parts. This is the lower sling swivel, and this is the upper sling swivel, whose use you will see when you are given your slings. And this is the piling swivel, which in your case you have not got. The branches hold in the gardens their silent, eloquent gestures, which in our case we have not got. This is the safety catch, which is always released with an easy flick of the thumb. And please do not let me see anyone using his finger. You can do it quite easy if you have any strength in your thumb. The blossoms are fragile and motionless, never letting anyone see any of them using their finger. And this, you can see, is the bolt. The purpose of this is to open the breech as you see. We can slide it rapidly backwards and forwards. We call this easing the spring. And rapidly backwards and forwards, the early bees are assaulting and fumbling the flowers. They call it easing the spring. It is perfectly easy if you have any strength in your thumb, like the bolt and the breech and the cocking piece and the point of balance, which in our case we have not got. And the almond blossom, silent in all of the gardens, and the bees going backwards and forwards. For today we have naming of parts.
Okay, so Harold, thank you very much for reading the poem for us. Did you enjoy it, first off?
Yes, very much so. It's a fascinating poem of contrasts and toying with what is real and what really matters in life, the universe and everything.
It's definitely the most literary sort of poem on our list. So can you tell us a bit more about how the themes of it spoke to you and what you found particularly interesting about what Reed was trying to say?
When I looked into it, I found that there was a considerable amount that picked up in some of the things that he'd written round about that time and was to publish a year or two later. He wrote a short series of poems based on the idea of basic training experience and how futile and banal some of that seemed to be when you look at what actually matters and what is real within the world. The Naming of Parts poem is the best known, and in the opinion of quite a number of people, it's the best of the set. And he picks up within that in a way that seems to flow better than the other poems within that series. This contrast between what wartime experience and the banality of so much of what happens is compared with things that are much more lastingly real and of lasting value that are being left behind because of the war situation. The poem was eventually published just after the war in a collection entitled A Map of Verona, And I found it fascinating that this concept of the map emerges in the poem that gives the collection its title, but also comes back in one of the other basic training programs. He uses these lines in the poem, A Map of Verona. And all was useless that I thought I learned. Maps are of place, not time, nor can they say the surprising height and colour of a building, nor where the groups of people bar their way. And that idea of the map being of place, not of time, gets neatly reversed in one of the other basic training programs that Reed wrote. It's in the poem Judging Distances. And he reverses the picture of what the map does to point out the absurdity of the military perception of reality and what seemed to matter to the rigid, fixed military mind. If I quote you a few lines, and please excuse one use of bad language, which is within the poem. He says this: maps are of time, not place, so far as the army happens to be concerned. The reason being is one which need not delay us. Again, you know there are three kinds of tree, three only, the fir and the poplar, and those which have bushy tops too. And lastly, that things only seem to be things. A barn is not called a barn, to put it more plainly, or a field in the distance where sheep may be safely grazing. You must never be over sure. You must say, when reporting, at 5 o'clock in the central sector is a dozen of what appear to be animals. Whatever you do, don't call the bleeders sheep. And this utter negation of what you can actually see in the face of this military restricted vision.
It's deeply ironic, isn't it, that he's almost presenting the military as the more objective force here.
Yep.
But for all that objectivity and that trying to put things into neat boxes and use the right vocabulary, it completely misses the point about what's important in the world and what's important about life.
I suppose. You're being channeled into this one direction, this one focus. There's only this one way of doing things, and it's got to be this way. I mean, one of the great virtues of what went on in Bletchley in the first years of the war is that people could be divergent thinkers. They could improvise, they could think outside the box and come up with some extraordinary perceptions and solutions to the code-breaking problems. Whereas the military mind was convergent, you've got to follow this line. And that poem seems to flow with extraordinary fluency between the banality of the NCO's explanation of naming the parts, a textbook addressing a nincompoop kind of thing, and the trainee's awareness as he listens to these words that there's a reality being left behind, a reality beyond the imposed wartime structure, nature in all its gentleness. You're having to go from the soulless to the sentient as you listen to the words in the poem, from the brutality to the beauty, from the metal to the meadow. And for me, the two voices, one spoken, the other seemingly in thought, are alternating right through with their own perception of what matters and what is real and what's ultimately going to matter more and is a greater reality. Until, alas, the trainee, almost with a sigh, reflects that for now, the reality has to be the pointless naming of parts. Whatever else you don't get right, you've got to get the naming of parts right.
I think that's an interesting undercurrent to this, is the irony in it. That Reed is making this point about what's important, but he's also sort of, he seems to conclude, and this is suggested in some of the other poems in that series as well, the narrator does sort of come to terms with this and start to accept the military mindset, doesn't he?
Yes.
And maybe he's mocking himself slightly in that, because it's known that Reed was himself a drill instructor for a time.
There is without doubt reflection of sadness and regret. The wartime has taken away the beauty, has taken away these things that are ultimately of great value by imposing its own mechanized reality onto life and onto humanity. Just as coming into the park meant sacrificing some of the freedoms that you had. Now that has to be channeled through the constraints of secrecy and the work that you have to do. And I can see it to an extent, a sort of parallel there, possibly unintentional, but I can see something of that there with the experience that Reed himself would have had coming to Bletchley and having to face those restraints in what he could and could not do.
Now, Harold, you know more about the cultural background of Bletchley Park than almost anyone, because you've done research into the drama group and the music society, haven't you?
Yep.
What do people like Reed bring to Bletchley? How do you think he slotted into this organisation when he arrived here?
My response to that would be, and perhaps it's a certain amount of guesswork, that I think there would be a similarity to a number of others who came in and worked in the arts and cultural activities, in that they did believe that there was a flame there that needed to be kept burning in the teeth of the wartime oppression, in the teeth of the threats of invasion, of the brutality of war, the scenes and experiences of death and destruction, and all that was threatened by Nazis in terms of what they were doing culturally. The need to maintain and preserve, nurture and develop and expand culture for its own sake, for its own value. Reed in poetry, the drama group looking at contemporary and traditional drama and maintaining the presentation of those and all the ideas that within them, the musicians continuing to play beautiful music. And I do think it's interesting that they did not shun German composers in terms of the programmes, either those who came to perform here, like Dame Mara Hess, or those who were playing and performing and singing within the context of Bletchley Park itself. They recognised the value of culture, and they were determined to maintain that and to keep it alive. And I think we see something of that in Reed and his poetry. It's particularly strong, I think, in Naming of Parts, where beauty is worth remembering for its own sake, even though it's being squeezed out by the demands of the wartime situation.
You've been here a great many years, and so I just wanted to ask you, what does Bletchley Park mean to you?
The word passion tends to come into answers a bit like this, although I never expected it to develop in quite the way in which it has been. I've been interested in the story of Bletchley Park for 30 years. Since it began to emerge while I was still on my teaching career. And the opportunity came when I was approaching retirement to follow that up and to use it as something I could step onto, keep my brain still working. When I finally finished teaching, I retired in the December. I began working at Bletchley in January the following year as a steward. And it's gone on from there. I've had the opportunities to research and study. Different topics have come up that have fascinated me. The Trust has been marvellous in letting me have access to things like the archives to pursue researches into topics like the drama group. Most recently, the access to all these records has enabled me to complete a book about Brigadier John Tiltman here. And I've been most grateful for all of that opportunity. So it's an overwhelming passion, which I hope I can maintain for a while yet.
And we're very grateful to you, Harold, for all that you've done for us, for all your dedication to all sorts of activities.
The privilege of being able to come and play in this universe that has been created, that is the world of Bletchley Park, is impossible to overstate.
From poetry about training during wartime to poetry about the aftermath of battle, one of the other most famous poems produced by a Bletchley Park poet is Soldiers Bathing by Frank Templeton Prince. Tom, can you tell us a little bit about the man behind the poem?
Yes, again, a very well-established literary figure. He's South African originally, alumnus of Balliol College, Oxford and Princeton University. He's very prestigious. Some of the sources describe him as a foreign policy analyst in the 1930s, so you can see why he would have been a prime candidate to go into the intelligence corps during the war. And he serves in the Middle East and in Italy for a big chunk of the war before coming to Bletchley Park. And a bit like Henry Reed, he writes Soldiers Bathing just after coming back from active service, just before he starts at Bletchley Park. And that is his most famous poem. He works here in the military section. He's an army officer. works on Italian as well, and also Japanese, as part of a section called JAFO, short for Japanese Forces, at the end of the war, doing Japanese Army or Japanese Air Force code breaking.
Was he a languages specialist then, do we think?
Yeah, it seems to be a very similar sort of background. Many of these poets come here because of their linguistic skills. They're not generally mathematically talented.
Mm-hmm.
He met his wife, actually, in the naval section here. So that illustrates there is a bit of fraternisation between sections going on, at least in the cafeteria, in the common areas.
Park romance, that's what we like.
And goes on after the war to have a long and productive literary career. But as you say, soldiers bathing, a real contrast to naming of parts, because it's all about the aftermath of battle, about how war dehumanises people.
Mm. It's a fantastic, quite profoundly emotional poem as well. And it's got sort of lots of classical references to it. It's a very long poem, so we're just going to read a few lines to familiarise people with this one, I think. We'll quote a bit of it because I think it's really important. We do include some of it.
Yeah, people may be familiar with just the opening stanza, which I'm going to read. The sea at evening moves across the sand. Under a reddening sky, I watch the freedom of a band of soldiers who belong to me, stripped bare for bathing in the sea. They shout and run in the warm air. Their flesh worn by the trade of war revives, and my mind towards the meaning of it strives.
So Soldiers Bathing, it's a fantastic poem which has themes of death and deals with the physical and emotional effects of the aftermath of battle. It has that sort of World War I style of speaking of both the pity of war, but also the personal, the physical and the emotional impacts on body and soul of combat. So it's really, it's a profoundly moving poem. I really recommend anybody to source it. It is out there. Have a look on the internet. We really recommend reading all of it. It was too long for us to deal with, unfortunately, in this brief podcast, but we really recommend it. I'd like us to move to a very different poem style now, though. Tom, we are looking at a poem, a piece of humorous verse that was written by Patrick Barrington.
We're going to start seeing a pattern emerging when I talk about Patrick Barrington. Pre-war, he's a literary figure. He's a writer for Punch. He writes humorous verse. He doesn't work at Bletchley Park initially. He's in Searchlight work. But again, he's invalided out and ends up here.
Bletchley Park has a backup plan in that case.
There are so many people at Bletchley Park who are here because they can't serve in the forces because of ill health.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. But you can imagine this is the perfect place for him. He is a member of the drama group here, a leading member.
Mm-hmm.
We've actually had a recent donation of a very large collection of his humorous verse. He's clearly scribbling away at any spare moment.
Mm.
Ideas running through his head. He's a very creative mind. You can just tell from the poem.
Away with words, doesn't he, as well?
Absolutely, and very good at what he does. And presumably very good at the work he does as well in air section, German codes, but also Japanese forces section again, just like F.D. Prince.
Mm-hmm. Let's listen to I Had a Hippopotamus by Patrick Barrington, read by our volunteer, Jeff.
I had a hippopotamus, I kept him in a shed, and fed him upon vitamins and vegetable bread. I made him my companion on many cheery walks, and had his portrait done by a celebrity in chalk. His charming eccentricities were known on every side. The creature's popularity was wonderfully wide. He frolicked with a rector in a dozen friendly tussles, who could not but remark on his hippopotamuscles. If he should be affected by depression or the dumps, by hippopotameasles or the hippopotamumps, I never knew a particle of peace till it was plain he was hippopotamasticating properly again. I had a hippopotamus, I loved him as a friend, but beautiful relationships are bound to have an end. Time takes, alas, our joys from us and rids us of our blisses. My hippopotamus turned out to be a hippopotamuses. My housekeeper regarded him with jaundice in her eye. She did not want a colony of hippopotami. She poured a machine gun from her soldier nephew Percy and showed my hippopotamus no hippopotamercy. My house now lacks that glamour that the charming creature gave. The garage where I kept him now is silent as a grave. No longer he displays among the motor tires and spanners his hippopotam mastery of hippopotam manners. No longer now he gambols in the orchards in the spring. No longer do I lead him through the village on a string. No longer in the morning does the neighbourhood rejoice to his hippopotam musically meditated voice. I had a hippopotamus, but nothing upon earth is constant in its happiness or lasting in its mirth. No joy that life can give me can be strong enough to smother my sorrow for that might have been a hippopotamother.
Jeff, you've read I Had a Hippopotamus by Patrick Barrington.
I have.
Did you enjoy reading it?
I did. It was fun. I never knew you could get so many words out of the word hippopotamus. And certainly other words I've never read before. But it was good fun and also very sad.
Mm-hmm.
As you go through it, you realise your landlady machine gunning your hippopotamus to death isn't quite as funny as when it started off, you know, as leading a hippopotamus through a village on a piece of string. But so it was a big contrast, but it was fun, yes.
Did you find it quite tricky to, I don't know, it's quite simple to say, get the words out, but did you find reading it?
Curiously enough, the hippopotamus words weren't when you had things like hippopotamumps and hippopotameasels and hippopotamusically meditated. But it was the other little ones that go in that I struggle with sometimes because he puts the word on and that in where it's not a natural thing for me.
Mm.
But the hippopotamy, it lent itself very easily to the flow. Yeah, it was quite good.
Very clever, isn't it?
It is.
I mean, the man who wrote it obviously became a co-broker at Bletchley Park.
So yeah.
There's a brain
and a
behind
Viscount.
It. Indeed, many strings to his bow. Do you think this is a good poem for kids, apart from obviously the gunning down element?
Yes, because it doesn't go into details about gunning it down. It just said, took a machine gun from her nephew Percy and now the hippo is no more.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think it's a good one for children. Yes, yeah, that's fine. I don't think they'll be traumatised by that.
Yeah, I think it's quite good for enunciation as well, maybe, the warming up of the voice.
It is, yeah. And you can go from happy and then work your way through to sad.
Right.
A bit sad, it's no more than that. So I think from a children's point of view, I think it'd be good.
Can you tell us what it is that you do at Bletchley Park?
I'm a volunteer steward. Apart from volunteering, I'm also a fire steward and a first responder as well. And I sit on the health and safety committee, but basically, you know, most of my time here is volunteering at all the various posts that we have to attend to. And I enjoy that. I mean, I was thinking of maybe I could become a guide, but I'd lose something because you meet the public a lot more as a steward when you're on your various posts. You meet them all the time, especially the information desk or just, you know, meeting and greeting at all the various places and meeting everybody that comes in and the enthusiasm that you see in the people. They come here for a reason. They come here because they know about the history. They're not coming to a theme park. They understand why they're coming here. So most of them are prepared in that way. But the ones who don't, obviously, I can, and my fellow stewards can fill them in on some of the detail that they don't know. And they're always very grateful. And they always come away from here saying, oh, I didn't know that. I had no idea this went on here. And that's the fantastic feedback that I get. And most of the volunteers do as well. I'm sure all of them. Because we're here volunteering because we like it, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. You must have to have a little bit of historical knowledge about all the places on the site when you're meeting people all around then.
You know, after nearly 9 years here as a volunteer, I'm still learning.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you learn less and less as the time goes on. You can still pick up bits and pieces, even sometimes from the visitors. And the good thing is you can crack a joke with somebody and they'll laugh, you know. And you can crack the same joke with another person and they'll laugh as well. And you can do the same thing week after week after week. And you can listen to your colleagues do the same thing. You think, oh, God, I've heard this one so many times. But, of course, the visitor hasn't.
Yeah.
Literally, I get about half a dozen people a day comment, you know, say, oh, love your waistcoat. And I say, well, thank you very much, you know.
I should say, Jeff is wearing a fantastic waistcoat and is known for the marvellous waistcoats he wears.
Do you know you can impart information or anecdotes to people and they would never have heard it before?
Mm-hmm.
That is a fascinating part of things, you know, especially like, if I'm on the information desk and they've just arrived and they're all kind of starry-eyed about, oh, where do I go now, you know.
But you're a helping hand as much as you are a bit of history as
well. Of course, yeah.
Piece of history, Jeff. But
piece of history myself.
Person with historical knowledge.
Thank you very much. Exactly. I'm done with that old door.
Thanks ever so much, Jeff. It's been lovely talking to you.
Thank you, Erica.
Our fourth poem is The Other Side by Patrick Wilkinson. And this is one of those unpublished ones you were talking about, isn't it, Tom?
Yes, I love this poem because it tells us so much about what Bletchley Park was like right at the beginning of the war. Patrick Wilkinson is the archetypal Don, really, of early Bletchley Park. He arrives just after war breaks out. He's a classicist. He's a classic codebreaker, mix of linguistic ability and sort of lateral thinking, puzzling ability.
His full name is Lancelot Patrick Wilkinson as well, which is absolutely wonderful.
Yes, and he certainly brings a certain, slightly, I don't want to speak him down, but slightly horsey nature, you feel like he...
Gentle mockery?
Yes.
Shall we say? Maybe that's his dry sense of humour.
What you can tell from the poem is he's clearly not entirely happy with how things are going at Bletchley. He sees room for improvement as far as the leadership in the organisation goes. And before we listen to the poem, it's important to know what the other side is referring to. Mm-hmm. Because at the start of the war, it's not just the government-owned cipher school at Bletchley Park. The idea is this is going to be the war station for the whole of the Secret Intelligence Service, SIS. Mm-hmm. And the other side is the term by which the codebreakers of GCNCS refer to everybody else in the Secret Intelligence Service.
Nowadays known as MI6.
Indeed. And this poem is read by our oral history officer, Jonathan Byrne.
In the inevitable hour of fate, at Bletchley Park the whistle went too late. Down came the marble pillars of the hall, the stained glass windows and the panelled wall. Dutch on Baroque, Baroque on Tudor fell, and underneath them lay the personnel. Vans of celestial utility transport these spirits to eternity. Sweet Boadicean chariot, swing low to waft Miss Wingfield where she has to go. See, see, they mount to find beyond the skies a brighter home than here at Apsley Guy's. Husbands that Crawley never dreamed about, and woven sands that never shall run out. There shall Hut 6 from seasons change immune enjoy an endless April, endless June. No groups are there, no charts upon the wall, but life is one long luncheon interval. High raised upon a pocket sapphire throne, sat AGD and bade the trump be blown. The watchers on the roof their trumpets blew, and into heaven the Bletchley spirits flew. Radiant with halos and with wings they shone, all washed in blood supplied by Henderson. The shade of Colonel Geoffrey led the race, for fear some saint should steal his private place. And there the next arrival saw him stand, grabbing ambrosial food with either hand. A motley crowd then came upon the scene, Miss White, Miss Brown, Miss Black, De Grey, De Green, and flocks of girls called mostly Pam or Jean. Campbell and Barnes and Aitken flapped around, like new-fledged birds afraid to leave the ground, while Hatto swooped about in childish glee, and all admired the style of Albury. Wings of all colours from their shoulders grew, from Adcock, pink, to heavenly Lucas, blue, a dazzling sight. On Mrs. Edward's head there beamed a halo of unearthly red. Straight cheese was black and of stupendous size, but for extension Hinsley's took the prize. So streamed they in, and last to avoid remark, the shy retiring shade of Edward Clark. A feast was piled upon the golden board, with nectar in the crystal mess trays poured. Bullock and Mrs. Babbage tried the food, and even they pronounced it fairly good. Birch praised the nectar too, but cautious grown, his wife had brought a thermos of her own. When all were full, and it was time to raise the inevitable harmony of praise, Higham, remembering his life below, began the public oratorio. But Turing's voice was raised above them all, drowning the harsh cacophonies of Wall, the unmelodious bellowings of Rees, and twittering alleluias of Miss Freese. Henderson toyed with gadgets on his harp, and Wilkinson sang flat and Tandy sharp. Oh, how Miss Wedderburn, with radiant face, boomed out hosannas in that manly bass! How Cooper all at once contrived to sing, and scratch his halo with contorted wing! When he could stand no more, the chairman rose, and thus addressed them in his lofty prose, full of benevolent paternal zeal. We were all cogs in one tremendous wheel, but let that pass. The wheel will not perceive the difference if we take perpetual leave. All recreations on this starry floor are in the hands of Squadron Leader Moore. Do as you please, follow your earthly bents. Behold, I make you all vice presidents. Then first sprang up the rounder section, which took the best part of heaven for its pitch. Barbara Abernethy doing her stuff, sceptre and planets borrowed soon enough. And while McVitie, deftly bowled with Mars, Wall gave exhaustive lectures on the stars. Then did Miss Linehan her skill display, with backhand shots into the Milky Way. And off between the pole and Charles's wain, Miss Pearson flapped her khaki wings in vain. The rest, no less to favourite sports were given. Green had a day out with the hounds of heaven. Orion's belt hung loosely round his waist, and horsed on Pegasus, the bear he chased. Or with the master Nimrod proudly walked, talking the language that archangels talked. Here Vincent and his skating galaxy cast themselves down upon the glassy sea. There Foss and Sapper Crawford dancing went, and stripped white sergeants to their heart's content. As in the vision that Isaiah saw, Bullock with Dr. Lion did eat straw. In Knox's den the weaned child did play, and Page and Bradshaw down together lay. Now more than ever seem it rich to die. Yet in that ointment there was one big fly. One fly there was, it could not be denied. The other side was on the other side.
Jonathan, there's lots of people's names in this poem. Did you recognise quite a few of them?
Yeah, most of them. I think they're all, hope they're all, on the Bletchley Park Roll of Honour, which is the list of all those we know of who worked at and for Bletchley Park in the Second World War. And it's worth looking up because you can find out quite a lot about some of these on our website. Yeah,
Patrick Wilkinson included, the
yes, indeed.
Poet himself.
Yes.
As the oral history officer, do you come across quite a lot of examples of these songs or poems or ditties that mention other veterans?
Yes, we do, both in the interviews, but also the correspondence that we've been receiving at Bletchley Park for many years now. Often we've had them for more than one person. You know, the same poems, the same songs crop up, so clearly had quite a major part in the sort of social side of Bletchley Park at the time. And there are lots of humorous references to senior people, or indeed often to junior people, to colleagues who, you know, we don't know a great deal about, but learn a little bit more from the poems, yeah.
And these are generally written down, aren't they? They're bits of paper that have been kept for years and years and years,
yeah,
by the veterans that you speak to decades later.
Yes, that's right. It's very often handwritten, of course, yeah, occasionally typed if you're lucky. And, you know, if they're handwritten, they often do take a little bit of decrypting, funny enough, yes.
Very apt. In this poem, Wilkinson was really witty. He's kind of, I suppose, gently mocking or quietly ridiculing his colleagues. Are there any particular bits of this poem that struck you as particularly outstanding or that you particularly liked?
I particularly liked the bit about Frank Birch and his wife bringing a thermos of her own. Clearly a very, very cautious lady. Maybe was used to the food at Bletchley Park. Perhaps wartime food wasn't everything it was cracked up to be.
Mm-hmm. How do you think people might have taken this when they were listening to this being performed?
Difficult to say. I'm sure one or two people might have been a little bit put out to have their names being taken sort of in jest, although I hope most of them would have seen the funny side of it and perhaps said, yes, I'm a bit like that sometimes, aren't I, or something like that. So, yeah, because these are all quite senior people, or many of them were, certainly. And indeed, AGD, of course, is Denniston himself, who's mentioned, although not too scurrilously in this case.
With all due respect,
yes,
isn't it?
Yes, he's very much in charge. Yes, that's right, yeah. But Josh Cooper, his habit of scratching his back while talking or something, I think that's the reference to the contorted wing. So so that there's obviously a reference there. But I suppose someone like Wilkinson, he was, I think, already a Cambridge Don before the war. So, you know, he probably felt quite happy talking about these people. He didn't, you know, he wasn't fazed by their seniority because he was fairly senior himself. Mm. Yeah.
It's quite tempting to produce a modern day version of this for Bletchley Park amongst our colleagues. It's a wonderful kind of template.
Now, there's a thought.
There is a thought. Exactly. From a personal perspective, you've obviously been interviewed for the podcast. Have you performed much poetry like this in your time?
Not really. I mean, I suppose I've read the odd thing out at school and things and at, you know, the odd sort of event, but not a great deal. I like this. I did take it home and practice it. And sort of the more I read it, the more amusing it became. And I thought, well, I can do something with this. Yes.
It's a very readable poem, isn't it? Yeah. As off the page as it is to listen to it.
Yeah. And I think it helps, of course, that, you know, most of those names are familiar to me, so you can sort of adjust the way you say it occasionally to suit what you know about the personality, yeah.
I suppose that gives a sense of what it must have been like during the war, where everybody knew everybody that was being referred to here. It must have been just one big in-joke.
Yeah. Yes, definitely, yeah. And other poems, you know, do address the, you know, as I said, the senior people for the amusement of the junior people, yes.
As it always has been and as it always will be.
Yeah, quite right.
Jonathan's already spoken about the in-jokes and the hidden references in this poem. Can you help us understand a few more of them? Give us a bit more of the background.
Yeah, there's so much fascinating detail here. There's references to Rounders games. There's references to utility vans, which were used to transport documents, which is just lovely. Mm-hmm. There's That implied criticism of the architecture of the mansion.
I think that's my favourite line. I love it.
Dutch on Baroque, Baroque on Tudor fell, and underneath them lay the personnel. Because Wilkinson is exactly the sort of person who comes to the mansion and decides it's a maudlin pile.
I can't help but agree with him, the vile appearance of the many different mishmash of styles.
That it's just Victorian gauchery.
Yes, I love
it. This building
it.
That's meant to look old, but it's only from 1880. It's just the naffest thing these people can imagine. So that's brilliant detail. It tells us so much also, because it mentions so many names. It tells us about the interconnectedness of Bletchley at that time. Mm-hmm. Wilkinson's in the naval section. Even though he's a new recruit, he knows all the big names, especially in the naval section, but a bit more broadly.
Yeah.
You get the impression naval is the hub of the organisation at this point.
Well, we're talking October 1940. How big would the staff numbers list been at the time?
Well, by this point, there were about 1,000, maybe.
Crikey.
Approaching 1,000.
Wow.
So it's getting a lot bigger than it was maybe the previous year when Wilkinson arrived, but there's still this tight-knit community of big names in the middle of it.
Yeah.
But there are some people who are left out. You have people like Harry Hinsley is mentioned working in Hut 4, so well-known to all the naval people.
Mm-hmm.
Frank Birch, names you would expect to see. You've got quite a lot of military section people as well. You have Alan Turing, but you don't have anyone else, it seems, from the Enigma side of the work, who's really obvious. No Gordon Welshman.
No.
There is a reference to Dilly Knox, but again, Knox is so well known as chief cryptographer.
Mm.
You know who he is, even if you don't know what he's working on a particular day. But there's a lot of people who we know were very important in Hut 6 and in Hut 8 in this period that don't get a mention. So that illustrates the compartmentalisation. But the fact that Turing is named,
yeah,
maybe he was quite well known. Maybe he had a bit of fame outside his own section at this point. So it's interesting to think about what that tells us.
Yeah. I think I need to listen to it again and work out who's not there, which is going to be an interesting challenge.
My favourite parts are the ones that tell us about the discontentment you can sense from Wilkinson.
Mm-hmm.
He has this criticism of the other side, and we know there was a lot of animosity between the two organisations because the other side get all the resources and GC&CS are a bit of a Cinderella by comparison,
mm-hmm.
but also within GC&CS as well. And that implied criticism of the leadership of Alistair Denniston, perhaps.
Mm.
There were people within the organisation who thought he was a nice guy, but he wasn't the effective leader that it needed. And as we know, later on, he does have a downfall a year or two later.
Interestingly, Travis, who replaced him and was his number two, isn't mentioned in this poem.
Yeah, that is curious, isn't it?
Quite something to leave out.
My number one favourite part is where they've all arrived in heaven and Denniston stands up and gives them a sort of speech, a sort of order of the day. We've had a couple of these used in the podcast before. He did issue these orders of the day at a couple of points in 1940, around the time of the Battle of France and the Battle of Britain, to sort of inspire the staff. But you can imagine there were certain people in the offices who rolled their eyes at that approach to leadership.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't feel it was really genuine. And so it has a bit of a spoof of it in this poem, but there's another document from Patrick Wilkinson, which has come down to us, which is a pretty direct spoof of a Denniston order of the day. And I just want to read that out because
sure.
It gives you a bit of context to what he's aiming at in the poem. It goes, "In this pregnant hour in which we are keeping our tails flying and pulling together with backs to the wheel, I appeal to you all to keep the powder dry on your stiff upper lips. There are two watchwords which may help you to weather the impending abyss. Stay put and go to it. And five groups more. Let us pay our lunch money with British cheerfulness. Never in the pages of our history has so much been owed by so many. We are fortunate to have plums and mess traps at all. Let us not spread alarm and despondency by describing to others the horrors which we have to endure." So there's a lot in there. You get the impression that Wilkinson and maybe some of his colleagues see Denniston as a slightly distant figure.
Mm.
They mostly hear about him when he's asking for the lunch money,
their
canteen contributions. He's not being as immediate a presence in the working spaces as they'd like. And the other times they hear about him is when he issues these orders of the day, but they don't really respond to them in the way that is intended. And maybe a hint here at the end, maybe that Denniston is being a bit dramatic, that people like Wilkinson think they've actually got quite a cushy position.
Mm.
They shouldn't be complaining. They should just be getting on with the job. They want the resources and the proper leadership to help them do that, and they're not quite getting it. So an undercurrent of discontent through all of these pieces of documentation, which I find really fascinating. And which I think tells us a lot about what Bletchley was like in the early war period.
One thing that strikes me, there's so many of these named individuals and in-jokes. This could be seen as just a nice, witty poem about Bletchley Park that Wilkinson's popping in a notebook for his later digestion. but actually, definitely, it feels like quite a critical, subtly subordinate piece of creativity that's probably being shared around as well, around the other staff. Do you get a sense that he was creating an undercurrent of subordination?
Yeah, maybe
it's
just like act of resistance. Maybe it's just therapeutic. Maybe it's just to let him and his colleagues get the weight off their shoulders about what they're feeling.
Nowadays, we'd stand in the kitchen or around the water cooler and have a good moan about work.
Or we'd make a meme.
Yeah, exactly.
I certainly would anyway,
you
people
would.
Of my generation. But back then, they write a poem.
Our next poem is not about Bletchley Park or Buckinghamshire. It moves further across the country to Wales. A very well-known Welsh poet, Vernon Watkins, was here at Bletchley Park. And Tom can tell us a little more about him.
Yeah, Watkins is maybe a slightly underrated figure, but a giant, really, of Welsh literary culture. He's best known for The Ballad of the Mary Lwyd, which he wrote just before coming to Bletchley Park. Again, there's that pattern. And known as part of a group of bohemians, really, who hang out in Swansea at the Cardamer Cafe, and they're known as the Cardamer Gang. And they include another Bletchley Park veteran, the composer Daniel Jones. But they also include Dylan Thomas, who's obviously the most famous Welsh literary figure of all. Famous especially for Under Milk Wood on the BBC, but all sorts of other poems and dramas. And we'll see, maybe the poem we're about to hear makes a bit of a reference to these connections. There's a reference to Cwmdonkin, which is either Cwmdonkin Park, which Thomas was very familiar with. He lived just around the corner on Cwmdonkin Drive until the late 1930s, and potentially there a reference to a place that Watkins himself knew quite well. And it's this cultural milieu that these people exist in which defines their careers and then defines how Watkins and Jones will make their way to Bletchley Park in the war as well. And it's slightly poignant because it all ends during the war. Swansea gets badly blitzed. The Cardamer Cafe gets bombed and is no more, and the group sort of disperses, and Dylan Thomas goes off to his whirlwind career. But I found a really interesting section from a broadcast he made in 1947 called Return Journey, and it's about Thomas going back to Swansea, walking through the bombed out streets and thinking about how things were before the war. And part of it goes, Dan Jones was going to compose the most prodigious symphony, Fred Janes paint the most miraculously meticulous posture, Charlie Fisher catch the poshest trout, Vernon Watkins and young Thomas write the most boiling poems, how they would ring the bells of London and paint it like a tart. So they're sitting in Swansea, they're having all these plans and all these dreams, and then it all ends thanks to the war. But it's just because they are big thinkers that some of them arrive at Bletchley Park. So Watkins himself, we know he was in the RAF police before Bletchley Park. I wonder if, quite a typical story again, maybe he doesn't really take to the military life. He wasn't a particularly military figure. He was almost too eccentric for that. Again, quite typical of Bletchley. And whether somebody notices he's got a brain on him and maybe working codes and ciphers might be up his street. But also he'd worked in banks. And we know lots of people who worked at Bletchley were from the banking trade because they were good at managing information. So maybe that turned out to be a better qualification. We're not quite sure. Mm-hmm. But it's here he met Gwen Davies from Birmingham. She worked in the air section, like Vernon. And she later wrote a book called Cracking the Luftwaffe Codes, all about that work, which is really valuable one for us because it covers areas that nobody else has written about.
It's always on your desk. I've noticed that.
It is. It's one of my favourites. Absolutely. And they marry before the end of the war, move back to Wales. And Watkins never is really as famous as he should be during his lifetime, but goes on writing poetry. He's well known nowadays. He's actually been considered for the Poet Laureate, but this is a point where he dies in the 1960s. Mm. Maybe it attests to his character that he had been diagnosed with a heart condition, but he loved playing tennis and he kept playing tennis in spite of that. And it was during a tennis competition that he died. So he's somebody who really had a lust for life and refused to let anything hold him back. And that's quite interesting reflection on his character. But Erica, I'm going to let you introduce the poem because this is actually very special.
Well, we wanted to find the right person to read this poem by the Welsh bard Vernon Watkins. And we got in touch with the Watkins family. And Vernon's wife, Gwen, at the age of 99, has very kindly, especially for the Bletchley Park podcast, produced this fantastic reading of this poem, published in 1959, called Ode to Swansea.
Ode to Swansea. bright town tossed by waves of time to a hill. Leaning arc of the world, dense window, perched high on the slope of morning, taking fire from the kindling east. Look where merchants, traders and builders move through your streets, while above you your chandler's walls, herring gulls wheel and pigeons, mocking man and the wheelwright's art. Prouder cities rise through the haze of time, yet unenvious all men have found is here. Here is the loitering marvel, feeding artists with all they know. There where sunlight catches a passing sail, stretch your shell-brittle sands where children play, shielded from hammering dockyards, launching strange equatorial ships. Would they know you, could the returning ships find the pictured bay of the port they left, changed by a murmuration, stained by oars in a nighthawk's wing? Yes, through changes your myth seems anchored here. Staked in mud, the forsaken oyster beds loom, and the mumble's lighthouse turns through gales like a seabird's egg. Lundy sets the course of the painted ships. Fishers dropping nets off the Gower coast watch them, where shag and cormorant perch like shades on the limestone rocks. You I know, yet who from a different land truly finds the town of a native child, nurtured under a rainbow, pitched at last on Mount Pleasant Hill? Stone-rung streets ascending to that crow's nest, swinging east and west over Swansea Bay, guard in their walls Cymdonkin's gates of light for a bell to close. Praise, but do not disturb heaven's dreaming man, not awakened yet from his sleep of wine. Pray while the starry midnight broods on Singleton's elms and swans.
Bletchley Park Podcast would like to say many, many thanks to the Watkins family for their help and generosity in providing this recording. For our sixth poem, rather unusually, we have that prolific author, anonymous. It's a bit of a mystery about this one. The poem is called Speculation. Tom, tell us more.
Yeah, the background to this poem is that there is a young civilian member of staff called Lillian Wrigley, who works in the part of naval section working on Japanese in Hut 7. But she seems to be fairly junior. We don't know much about her. You can imagine this sort of drudge work that she would have been doing a lot of the time. And that's the reason I like this poem, because it tells us a bit about how things worked at the lower end of the scale, not just among the prestigious poets and authors and mathematicians at the top of the organisation.
So it's an insight into the minutiae of the work.
Yeah, and the sort of in-jokes and joshing maybe that went on lower down. So Lillian, the story goes, came back to her desk one day to find this poem had just been left on the basket that she used as a seat. And she never found out who wrote it, but somebody in her section. I think you can tell from the content of the poem, maybe she was the subject of a certain amount of mockery, but somebody appreciated having her around and they wrote her this quite touching bit of verse and left it for her to find. And now it's come down to us. So we're going to hear it read out with great aplomb by our member of staff, Lucy.
Who is it writes on cardboard plaques, funny jokes and witty cracks? Who is it makes our life so jolly, with gravestones grim, neath sprigs of holly? Who is it, with that manner cool, insists on basket as a stool? When she sits upon a chair, her feet will dangle in the air. Who is it sits as in a trance, for hours with dreamy distance glance? and studies many a varied theme. With keen perception, it would seem. Who is it trips with elfin tread among these dwellings of the dead? Unhurried, calm, sublimely cool, midst brutish clerk and gaping fool. Who is it bids us dry our eyes, wipes our tears, still our sighs? Who scatters wisdom, airy, sweet? The Rose of York knows no defeat. Who is it, in spite of this, forgives our sins, restores our bliss, with spirit mild in face of wit, and only stays to laugh at it?
It seems that you really enjoyed reading this poem. What particularly did you enjoy about this?
Well, I think immediately I saw, from the description of who the poem was about, mm-hmm. she's from Yorkshire.
So you felt a kind of connection?
Yeah. I mean, she could have been any part of Yorkshire because Yorkshire's huge. And the bit about the Rose of York, I really like that because, like, I'm from New York originally, so I was like, oh, yeah, she could be from New York. And I think looking at it as in terms of like the people that worked here, it gives an idea that from me myself, I was thinking, or everybody that worked here were all people of like, you know, Oxford, Cambridge. Mm-hmm. You know, this lady from obviously looking at her on her record, she was just someone who was probably considered like a temporary assistant, like she was just doing general work. And I think the nice like flow of the poem is it's the fact that, you know, this was something that they kind of did just to bide the time, I think, because mm-hmm. a lot of the work was probably very tedious and the same kind of work that they were doing day in, day out. And what's nice is it gives you a little bit of a snapshot, I think, into the like the working atmosphere maybe a little bit. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I really liked. I just was drawn to that and the fact that she's from Yorkshire.
Do you think it's brought you a bit closer to the individuals that worked here and given you a bit of an insight?
Yeah, I think a little bit more because I don't know. I just think it shows that, well, we know throughout the war in, you know, the whole country came together, didn't they? So it did break down those classes and everybody came together and kind of, say, like, appreciated one another and just got through it. You know, it does pick on her a little bit, you know, the fact that she was probably quite short and she needed a basket to sit on rather than a chair.
It's a bit hot.
Yeah, it's a little bit. But obviously, because we don't know too much about the background with Lillian, but from what I get from it, I'm hoping it's something that just a bit of fun, I suppose. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's a wonderful survivor of the kind of everyday, day-to-day relationships between people as well, isn't
it? Yeah, yeah.
And really rare to come across such a thing that might have just been a spoken comment or something, but it's been committed to paper and survived this long. How did you feel reading it? Was it an easy read? Were you able to quite early on get a sense of the person behind the words? It's quite a smooth way of writing, I think. Yeah. It's not too complicated. It's almost as if they've sat there and scribbled their own thoughts.
Yeah, I don't know. It's nice how it, as you said, it just nice how it flows.
Have you got quite a lot of prior experience performing? Because your read is absolutely fantastic in this poem.
Thank you. Yeah, I studied at uni, so I did drama at uni. I haven't performed in a few years because pandemic and everything. So it was nice to like do a bit of reading and performing again. That's what I really, really enjoy. And sometimes when you pick up a piece of work or when I read plays and things and you read a character in a text, like with anybody who's a bit like a performer, you kind of connect with it and mm-hmm. it's a nice feeling when you connect with something and then you're able to kind of express that. I like quite a bit of Shakespeare because a lot of Shakespeare's works, obviously, it's that kind of a style. At uni we did bits of poetry reads as well as, because we did a few sonnets, like Shakespeare sonnets. But yeah, it's been a long time since I've done something like this. Yeah, it was nice to do something again. You can get quite a lot from such, even if it's such a short poem. It's just exciting because you can picture little bits of people's lives and what they do. And I don't know, it's just exciting, yeah.
Speaking about people's lives, can you tell us a little bit about what you do at Bletchley Park?
I work in the visitor service team. So I've worked here for about a year and 3 months now. So I work in Block C in the visitor centre. Obviously, I serve customers in the shop as well. I find it really exciting because, like, I've learned so much just from, like, working here more so than when I visited because I've been able to delve in a bit deeper about what happened here, people here. So it's really exciting. My favourite part is chatting with visitors about their relatives, if they've got relatives here. They're trying to find out a bit more about it. I think that's the exciting part because I can't count how many people that I've had, but I've had people that their relatives that had all kinds of different roles here. And it's really exciting listening panicked about those, and when they're trying to ask for some help about it. And and sometimes when you look at the records, because obviously the records are so, sometimes are so basic, it's really difficult to say exactly what they did here, because we know it was top secret. Yeah. So that's the exciting part, is engaging with visitors about those. And that's what I like about doing my role. Yeah.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
We're returning to some serious history now.
And some serious politics.
Some serious politics, exactly the context of the serious history, with our next poem and our next poet. The poem is Splendours of Isolation, and the poet is F.L. Lucas.
F.L. Lucas is an established figure before the war as an anti-fascist writer and sort of campaigner. And he writes into newspapers, he writes to the letters pages, and he's sounding the warning about Hitler, Mussolini, about the rise of these fascist governments, and about all the problems they're going to cause. And that is a fascinating background to how he comes to be at Bletchley Park. He's obviously an extremely intelligent figure. He has all his languages from his Oxbridge education, but he also has just the right political background. There are people at Bletchley who are interested in the work for various reasons, out of their own interest. You know, Turing's never very political. He sees the work as an interesting puzzle, an interesting challenge for him to overcome. Lucas is here because he thinks it's utterly important, and it always has been important. He's been writing about this for years. And this poem is from 1935. So as early as that, he's publishing poetry, which is drawing attention to the political situation in Europe and complaining about the complacency in Britain. And when we were doing the Early Days exhibition, we feature Lucas in one of our AVs. Mm-hmm. And I spent quite a lot of time, if you remember, Erica, and you helped me out with that, looking at the newspapers,
yes,
at these letters, to try and find a really nice pithy quote that would sum up who Lucas was and why he was a good recruit for Bletchley Park. We didn't find that much because it's bitty evidence.
Also, Lucas and pithy aren't two words that necessarily go together.
No, indeed. But what I should have been doing all along is looking at his poetry.
Well, yeah, because he was a poet in 1935, and this was published in 1935, but early on in the war. He's not really known later on as a poet. He sort of moves into being more of a critic, more of a very opinionated person. And the poetry seems to sort of sit aside. But the poems, as you say, not all about the political situation, some more personal ones, ode to whatever.
Some about his experience in the First World War. He was in the infantry in the First World War. Some quite moving verse about what that was like and the impact it had on his life, certainly.
Absolutely.
So he was a genuine war poet as well,
yeah,
on top of everything else.
Definitely. But this one, as you say, this shows the will to warn others almost, to highlight the contemporary politics of the time.
He works in Hutfree here, and he's actually in charge of a section called Hutfree G, which stands for General, doing all of that background research that goes on behind the scenes while the people front of house, so to speak, are processing, translating, sending out decrypts as quickly as possible. There are people doing longer term research, and Lucas oversees all of that work, so a very important role.
We had a look at a version of Splendours of Isolation in a version in the British Library, in a book published in 1935, first edition, in order to make sure we actually had the accurate text, because he's not widely in print at the moment. And in that version, at the top of this poem, Splendours of Isolation, there's a quote printed, which is a quote from the Evening Standard of April the 22nd, 1935, which says, "The British policeman should stick to his own beat." Now, with the rest of the poem, here's our volunteer Pam.
"There shall be no more sea," the apostle cried, "but it was heaven that his dream descried. Each day our seas grow less before our eyes, but their tides retreating bring no paradise. Nearer each day, not dearer, land to land, with wings of war, not peace, our heaven is spanned. Bridged is our moat, our island gem unset. Still, all's not lost. Our press lords lead us yet." The crawling waves Canute's voice could not stem, flood back obedient at one word from them. One magic word, the word of true salvation, those syllables of splendour, isolation. Paris may pass in gas and flame and blood, we shall sit safe behind our sundering flood. Berlin may build a holier inquisition, it will but mean an extra late edition. Hitler be hailed through all erect Ukraine. We shall just read and turn to golf again. For God, the day our guardian seas he took, gave us the broad breast of a beaver brook. round us though fails the channel, never fear, still lie the stainless steps of Rothermere.
Pam, you've said that you particularly enjoyed reading this poem. What was it that has particular appeal to you?
I think because it fascinated me, first of all, because it was written in 1935. And the impression you get from reading books and the media is that in the 1930s, Britain was just sort of hoping that there wouldn't be another war with Germany, even while there were signs to the contrary. And Churchill, as we all know, he'd been giving warnings throughout the 30s about German rearmament, but he was just being ignored. And few were prepared to listen. But now I know that Admiral Sir Hugh Sinclair, who was headed up the intelligence services, he was starting to prepare from the early 1930s. And I find that even, you know, many, many years later, quite reassuring because you don't get the feeling nowadays from our media that much planning ahead by government is done.
Even if it is, it's certainly not, as you say, the impression.
No, not at all.
We feel possibly like we think happened in the 30s, that there was this sleepwalking into catastrophe or chaos.
Yeah. I mean, it's possible it's happening under wraps. One can only hope.
I mean, Lucas seems to have been a very well-connected individual, a very informed individual. Do you get that sense through his poem that he's warning, or do you think he's just tired of the situation?
I don't see how he could be warning, because I don't know how wide the publicity would have been for the poem, how many people other than perhaps his peers would have been aware of it. I suspect because he was himself an anti-fascist, he was just frustrated with the situation. And the fact that there's all these rather sarcastic references to the power of the press barons, and they seem to be conveying an impression through the media to the population at large that we are invulnerable in our island. But then one has to remember that Beaverbrook was an isolationist and Rothermere had fascist sympathies.
This was published, we shouldn't forget, in 1935. So it feels quite gutsy to go up against those big names in print at that time.
Well, you say in print, but where in print? I don't know that. I haven't found that out. But also he was a Cambridge academic. And one has to wonder how much notice was taken. I mean, academics have always seemed to have been left-leaning anyway. So perhaps they just thought an academic having his say, carry on as we were. I really don't know. It's surprising when you think that was a whole 4 years before we entered the war. And a lot of what he's saying, it could have been written much later and still been absolutely accurate.
What about his style particularly struck you in the way that he's written? Did you find it very easy to read, or did you have to study the poem quite a few times?
I had to study it a few times to actually get the meaning, because there's not punctuation necessarily where I would have put it. But once I'd decided on the meaning, I then found it quite easy to add emphasis. So that made it satisfying to read.
Yeah. Have you done much of this before, reading of poetry in public?
Not since I was a child. No,
really?
No.
Did you enjoy doing this, or did it bring back memories of reading poetry as a child?
Yeah, it brought back memories. Of my mother sent me to elocution lessons.
Fantastic.
A lot of mothers did in those days. And I did remember some of the things I was told, because I used to be entered for competitions. So, you know, I had to stand up at the age of 8, 9, 10, reciting. I think I won the occasional one.
Well, I hope this wasn't quite as nerve-wracking, this experience.
It was, because I don't normally like to put myself in the public forum. I know, I'd like to keep under the radar.
Well, you say that, but you are also a volunteer here at Bletchley Park, and you have a lot of interaction with our visitors in various ways. Could you tell us a little bit, first of all, about what you do here at Bletchley Park?
Oh, I've done lots since I joined 8 years ago. I started off as a steward, and then a few months later, I started helping in the archives. And at the time in the archives, we were cleaning some of the small record cards, and we were also checking things that had been transferred by scan onto computer. So, of course, I started cleaning and seeing some of the messages. It was the three headlines. Wow. And I tell you, for someone who's been fascinated by the Second World War since I was a teenager, this was just history coming to life, to see these headlines, to see the Hitler messages. And then after that, after about 4 years, I put myself forward for guide training because they wanted more guides. And I was accepted. And that was amazing to be accepted.
I have to admit, I have heard your tours and they are absolutely wonderful.
So I really enjoy that. And that, of course, learning what we have to say and what we don't have to say has made me research other things. So it's helped me find out so much more about Bletchley Park.
It's impossible not to be drawn into it, isn't
it? Absolutely. And then in between all that, I got involved in transcribing veteran interviews, and then I even did some veteran interviews, so even better. Bletchley Park makes me very proud to be British, because I love this country, warts and all. Bletchley Park has given me so many opportunities, I tell you. It's allowed me to indulge my fascination with World War II, and I'm surrounded by lovely people who are equally fascinated, so you can be as completely nerdy as you like in your conversations. It's great. And talking to different people, you pick up things. This is how I learned a lot in the early days. Just talking to people who'd been here longer and reading books.
Yeah.
And now, of course, we have our historians doing podcasts, which is amazing because you can be pretty sure that what you're hearing on one of our podcasts has been very well researched information. And it gives you confidence. Well, for me, change my tour script and say, add it in. So that's so nice.
So not just a listener to the podcast, you are now part of the podcast.
I know.
Thank you so much.
What have I done?
Thank you, Pam. Cheers.
Thank you.
Our eighth poem, Activity Nil, is one of those unpublished poems from our collection. The author is on our roll of honour, but as regular listeners will know, Bletchley Park veterans aren't just necessarily people that worked on this estate in Buckinghamshire. Many of them were part of the enormous number of outstations and Y services that supported Bletchley Park's work. The poet here is Ursula Smith. Tom, can you tell us more about Ursula and Activity Nil?
I can certainly tell you about the sort of work she was doing. Again, with people at the lower end of the scale, we don't know a lot about the individuals. But I put this poem forward because I felt it's really important to have a voice from outside Bletchley Park itself, as you say. We know that Ursula Smith was a intercept operator in the Women's Auxiliary Air Force, and she worked at what are called Home Defence Units, which are a type of Y station operated by the RAF. These were all around the coast of Britain, and they worked on voice traffic, so sort of unencrypted voice communications. But Bletchley Park has a hand in this work because it's full of code names. You have to understand all the call signs and frequencies, just like other radio traffic. So they're monitoring, in the RAF case, mostly aircraft, of course, but occasionally things like e-boats that are also using voice traffic. Operating off the coast of Britain, they're helping to protect Allied convoys and spot bombing raids as they're coming in over the coast. So really important work in that early period of the war. But the nature of voice radio and very high frequency radio is it doesn't travel very far. So you have to have these stations spread out all along the coast, and they can only pick up traffic from quite a small area. And in 1941, Smith was up at the RAF station in Scarborough. Mm-hmm. Some of our listeners might know that in Scarborough, there's a very large Royal Naval Y station, but she's not at the Naval Y station. She's at the RAF station, which is on the Castle Mound in Scarborough. Don't know a lot about that station, but presumably a small hut with a radio in it and some aerials and not a lot else, mm-hmm. exposed on the clifftop there in the castle. And what the poem's really about is the fact that a lot of the time she didn't have a lot to do. These people have to scan the airwaves even when nothing much is happening out there, just in case activity does occur. Mm-hmm. And the frustration of being in that position is what the poem encapsulates really well. And I think our volunteer Maria did a really good job of capturing the feeling of this poem as well. Nice. When she recorded it for us.
We sit and we twiddle our young lives away. We twiddle all night and we twiddle all day. They say it's for victory. We wouldn't know. But search every frequency, high, medium, low. We fiddle with knobs, adjust audio gain. But somehow we know it will all be in vain. For do what we will, activity's nil. A signal comes up. We have nothing to do. So we tune in on broad to an over to you. Sometimes, if we're lucky, we even get Morse. But, needless to say, automatic, of course. And then, though we really don't think it's much fun, we log in a beam on 30.1. But apart from this thrill, activity's nil. We long for the music to fall on our ear of a Teutonic voice saying, "Here, Bruno Fear," or a message tapped out in meticulous Morse from a U-boat or E-boat that strayed from its course. But all that we're likely to get on band two is a prosaic, "I have a message for you," and the answer is still, activity nil. The wind howls around us, the hut fills with smoke, our eyes are red-rimmed, we splutter and choke. There are things more heroic and valiant by far, but it's our contribution to winning the war, to twiddle for victory, country and king. But we wish there was some other song we could sing than Activity Nil, Activity Nil.
Maria, you were the reader for Activity Nil. Very first question I have for you, did you enjoy reading it?
I loved reading it. It felt a privilege to read it. I thought the poem was very straightforward and simple to read. And I loved the flow of it. And I thought Ursha, who wrote it, was very descriptive in her role and where she was and what was expected of her. And I enjoyed reading it because I just thought it was amazing that she had written that 80 odd years ago, probably in a very kind of bored moment. And to think that 80 years later, I'm talking about it and reciting it for a podcast, which you'd never have believed.
Absolutely. And it's secret work that she was doing, and she's putting down her own feelings.
Yeah.
Do you feel you got a bit of an insight into her personality?
I thought from all the information, all the books I've read and being at Bletchley Park, that it really made me feel like it was a true representation of what it must have been like for her.
Mm-hmm.
When she talks about she's in a hut, it's windy outside, the hut's filled with smoke. It just confirmed everything that I'd read and talked to veterans and what they'd said about their experiences. And it just felt a touch closer to the real time reading a poem that somebody had written.
It's such a, as you say, such a personal angle of finding out about a historical event as well, isn't it?
Yeah, and I felt for her. I thought, if only, you know, it's like all those things. I thought, if only she knew, you know, she's sat there, she's really well trained, she's gone through a lot to be that experience, to do that job of interception. And I felt like she was frustrated because one of the lines that struck me when she put, it's our contribution to winning the war, she's quite clearly knows her role and knows it's important.
Mm-hmm.
But she talks as if she just like the chance to prove something, to really feel like a real part of it, like she's made a massive difference. And her frustration and her boredom comes through. But also she's got this pride because she mentions for country and king. And so, you know, you can tell that she knows that it's positive. But actually, at the time, it's a long shift and she's tired.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's tough. It's tough.
But she's almost kind of making sense of it, contextualizing in her head through the writing of it.
Yeah.
Do you think you felt anything different in the fact that this is poetry rather than, say, just reading an account from a veteran about the work that they did?
I love poetry.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, when I said I chose the poem because it was an easy read, because it's so simple, straightforward, easy listening, but it puts across the same as, you know, you could read very bland pages in a book to get the same information, but you get the emotions come through on every line when it's in a poem.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's why I like poetry and really enjoyed her poem.
Listening to you read it seems so natural. Have you done this kind of thing before?
No, I've never done anything like this before, nothing to do with any media. But I know that I'm always getting told that I don't stop talking. So my mum always used to say to me, just get on with eating your dinner and stop talking because you're always the last to finish. So, yeah, I just knew that I'd love the opportunity if anything involves talking. I'm up for that.
Fantastic. Well, it's definitely worked out here.
Good.
It's a lovely read.
Good.
You are a volunteer at Bletchley Park. Can you tell us a tiny bit about what you do and also what it means to you to be a volunteer here?
It means everything being a volunteer here because of all the work that went on and the sacrifice that the whole country made at every level, including all the women that went out and got these roles. And it's just such a unique place because it's where it happened. It's not a museum that's been set up. It's the place and it's adapted to encourage visitors. And, it, you know, it's a real unique experience to come. So being able to volunteer here is
again, it's a unique opportunity to be a volunteer here, and I enjoy it because on so many levels, there's all sorts of volunteering. I do stewarding, so I get to meet the public all the time, and you just never know. It's one of those things, you walk in the door and you just don't know what you're going to get asked or who you're going to meet, and it's absolutely incredible. I meet people that I would never, ever have had the opportunity to meet, staff and volunteers, and doing things like the podcast.
Mm-hmm.
Never in my life would I have got that opportunity. So it opens up lots of opportunities, and I've made long-term friends as well, which are a great support in life anyway. So yeah, it's brilliant.
Fantastic. What is it about the Bletchley Park story that particularly speaks to you?
I like the social side, the social history.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that you learn about the war and about men going to war, but it's just the whole family process, how it affected everyone. And also, for me, it's really important to pass it on through the generations,
mm-hmm.
to never take for granted your freedom, because we're so lucky now to be able to have the freedom to get up in the morning and do what we want. And it's because of all that sacrifice. So it's really important to get the education, take it on through the generations, and also for them to learn from it for future.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
For our final poem, this is one that visitors to the site might recognise or listeners to the podcast might recognise. We've not ignored this poem in the past. It's one of the better known ones about Bletchley Park, and the title is Bumph Palace, BP. To help explain its context, its background, and a bit about its mysterious authorship, Tom, would you tell us more?
This is probably the best known piece of verse associated with Bletchley Park and about Bletchley Park. We have actually no fewer than 18 copies in our collection. That's physical copies. We've got other ones which are purely digital.
And we're not talking identical copies here either.
No, various different versions. And that's what's interesting about it. But for all of that, we don't know who wrote it. We don't know precisely what its origins were. Lots of spurious attributions over the years, because there are people's names written on many of these documents, but they're evidently people who owned that particular copy of the song. They don't seem to indicate who wrote it. But certainly a humorous work. Bumph, for those who are not familiar, is short for bum fodder, i.e. toilet paper,
uh-huh.
as a reference to the sort of unnecessary paperwork that you might find around a place like Bletchley Park. So that's very appropriate. It's also important to understand that it's performed to the tune of a song called Trees, which our listeners might be familiar with, by Nelson Eddy. Very popular tune during the war. It is a very earnest, kind of winsome, romantic ode to the beauty of trees.
Not catchy nowadays, one would say.
It's not catchy, but... and it's not humorous. It seems like when it was performed at Bletchley Park, Bumph Palace was almost always sung.
Mm-hmm.
And you can imagine how funny it would have been if somebody went on stage and started singing this very operatic tune, very earnest operatic tune about trees. And then, after a couple of lines, veers off talking about how Bletchley Park is peopled by the strangely dressed. I think it would have caused a stir in the room and been very, very funny at the time.
Mm-hmm.
We do have some information about the origins of this ditty. We have some evidence it was actually performed at the VJ Day party right at the end of the war, just before everybody leaves. Mm-hmm. They all get together. And we have a few clues that this was the case. We have a copy that came down to us from Stanley Sedgwick, who was secretary of the Ballroom Dancing Club. And along with the copy of Bumph Palace, there's also a copy of the Bletchley Park alphabet. You can find the Bletchley Park alphabet on our roll of honour attached to some of the entries, because it refers to individuals at Bletchley Park, some of the higher up figures that everybody knew.
Oh, sort of named like the Patrick Wilkinson poem.
Yeah, and there's a verse for each of those figures. So C is for Crawley, the catering manager, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Normally when you see Bletchley Park alphabet, there's no X, Y and Z verses, because the author decides that they can't think of anyone by those names. In this version performed right at the end of the war, there are three extra verses for X, Y, and Z.
Mm-hmm.
And they include the Y verse, which goes like this. Y is for you, folks in the hall, as time passes by, I hope you'll recall, the dances you've been to here, above all, tonight, the Japanese Victory Ball.
Mm.
That's a really nice, clear indication of the context of that document. There's another version which has come to us from Mifanwi Cornwall-Jones of the Naval Section, and she's written in the corner, and I'm not sure whether during the war or some years later, but she was there, so she would know. She's written that it was sung by Douglas Jones straight at the last concert and noted down on an old envelope by M. Cornwall Jones. And so later she's gone away and typed it up into a nice neat copy and then annotated it. You know, it doesn't happen often enough that people write down on the corner of a document exactly what it is and where it came from and who wrote it. Mm-hmm. Really nice for my work. Now, we know about Douglas Jones. He was later known as Craig. He changed his surname because he worked in the theatre and he decided there were too many Joneses in the theatre, so he changed his surname to Craig. He was head of the Bletchley Park Signals Office, which is not the most interesting part of the organisation, perhaps. It's sort of the central post room. Every piece of traffic that goes in and out and between the various sections has to be logged and registered and kept track of. And that's what the signal office does. And it also runs a pneumatic tube system. But, you know, contrary to that, he's a dramatist, clearly a very interesting person. He went on to run Sadler's Wells Theatre after the war. And he's involved, again, with the drama societies while he's at Bletchley. Mm-hmm. So it seems like he's the one who performed this song at the end of the war, even if he didn't write it. So he can probably lay claim to it more than any one single figure can.
So while it's Bump Palace anonymous, we think there's some hint as to who it may be.
Yeah.
We'll stick with anonymous for now, though.
I wouldn't like to say Jones wrote it, but he performed it, and that's important to know. And there's two possibilities about where this came about. It's clearly written towards the end of the war. You have a reference in there to 6 years they've been here. So it indicates it came at the end of the war. And we can see from these various different versions that it circulated very widely among the staff. And I think this may have happened between VE Day and VJ Day when the staff were fairly idle in many cases. They had more time on their hands.
Okay.
And they heard this song and copies moved around and were swapped around and people copied it out. And when they copied it out, they made alterations. So we have all these different various parts of the song are worded in different ways. And there is one version with entire two lines, which is completely different from all the other versions we have. Mm-hmm. That version is headed Park's Song. So they haven't even got the title. And I think they've heard it from somebody else in the office and written down as much of it as they can, but they missed a bit, so they filled it in with something that sounded good.
Park Song sounds like it was so known, so ubiquitous, a bit like school song. You know, it's the representative song for the place.
Yes, it's really a test to how it spoke to people who worked here, how it encapsulated their experiences. Now, they've been here for years and somebody's written a piece of verse which everybody can kind of see themselves in. Mm-hmm. So maybe it's passing around between VE and VJ days in the middle of 1945, perhaps appeared right at the end of the war. And that VJ Day performance is the first time anyone's heard it. Because you have a reference in there to the atomic World War II. Mm-hmm. Maybe they're referencing the atom bomb.
Yeah.
And again, it gets passed around for a few days or a few weeks as people disappear back into civilian life. And they can take it as a souvenir because they're aware at that stage of the war that they're all going to go their separate ways and they want to remember what they did here. So it hints as to the sort of themes that everybody understood. They all agreed the civilians were scruffy, the uniformed personnel were ironic because they weren't actually doing any fighting or any dying like so many people were in the war. They agreed the work was tough. They agreed the local people weren't very friendly a lot of the time. They agreed on the secrecy and they all agreed that the whole thing was very strange.
This version of Bump Palace is read by veteran Betty Laurie. We actually recorded her for an exhibition that was here at Bletchley Park in 2017 to 2019 called Off Duty, which focused on the free time and welfare facilities that were provided for the people at Bletchley Park. Jonathan Byrne, our oral history officer, and I went to Betty's home to record this, and as far as I remember, she did it in one take. What a pro. Sadly, Betty passed away in 2021. Which is a reason we're even more proud to be able to present Betty Laurie reading Bump Palace.
I think that I shall never see a sight so curious as BP. This place, called up at war's behest, and peopled with the queerly dressed. Yet what they did, they could not say, nor ever shall till Judgment Day. For 6 long years we have been there, subject to local scorn and stare. We come by transport and by train, the dull, the brilliantly insane. What were we for? Where shall we be when God at last reduns BP? The Air Force types that never fly, soldiers who neither do nor die, landlubber sailors, beards complete, long-haired civilians, slim, effete. Why they were there, they never knew. And when they told, it wasn't true. If I should die, think this of me. I served my country at BP. And should my son ask, what did you in the atomic World War II? God only knows. And he won't tell. For after all, BP is hell.
Grateful thanks to those Bletchley Park staff and volunteers and our much-valued veterans who helped us create this episode. If you're a more visual person, check out our Bletchley Park YouTube channel to see some of these Bletchley Park poetry performances.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.